And so we've been working through the Sermon on the Mount. And as we come to chapter 6, we actually come to this new section in the sermon. And so just kind of recap real quick where we've been. At the beginning of the sermon in chapter 5, verses 3 through 12, Jesus, talking to his disciples, says, okay, this is who you are. If you notice, as you read the Beatitudes, it says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. This is the type of character that my disciples have. So this is who you are. He lays out our identity. And then he moves immediately into verses 13 through 16 and says, okay, if this is who you are, this is how you'll interact with the world. You'll be salt. You'll be light. You'll basically stand out. Because this type of character in the Beatitudes, that's not normal in the world today. So you're going to stand out like salt in food. You're going to stand out like light in a dark room. And then he transitions to verses 17 through 48, this big section we just worked through. And he says, being salt and light, this changes the way you relate to the law. And specifically, you're going to have a righteousness that's far greater than your current teachers, the scribes and Pharisees. And as he walks through this, we see what he means. He said, he's continually working on character development because he's continually saying, you're not going to just obey the letter of the law. You're not just going to do the bare minimum. Rather, you're going to reach down into your heart, into your motives and desires, and begin to ask hard questions. Questions that aren't as simple as like, hey, did I kill someone today? But questions as complicated as this. Are there relationships in my life that I need to reconcile? Are there people in my life that I'm viewing and thinking about sexually and they're not my spouse? Am I an honest person? Are there people in my life that I'm kind of categorizing and pushing to the fringes and not loving them like I love others? He says you should use the law as this lens to get down deep into your heart, into your motives and desires. And that's the original intention of it. And now as he turns the corner into his second big section of this sermon, he wants to help us see this new relationship that we have with God. Specifically, this relationship that we have with God as our Father. Like verses in chapter 6, verses 1 through 18, Jesus is over and over and over again going to tell us, your Father. He's going to keep saying that, your Father, our Father. That is the title he uses over and over and over again for God. And this, at the time that he says all this, is a very transformative thing for the people who are listening. Because the people at that time did not use the title of Father, the title of Abba, like, which isn't just like daddy, but it's this informal way of just saying Father. Very personal relationship. They didn't use that for God. But that's the main way that Jesus talks about God. J.I. Packer, in his book, Knowing God, which is a tremendously great book I would recommend anyone and everyone to read, has a chapter about this very thing, about what he calls adoption, knowing God as our Father. And this is going to be kind of a long quote, but all of it's just amazing. Just track with me as I read this. He is talking about God as Father. Here's what he says. He says, in the Old Testament times, God gave people a covenant name by which to speak of him and call upon him. The name Yahweh, the Lord. By this name, God announced himself as the great I Am. The name proclaimed him as self-existent, sovereign, and wholly free from constraint or dependence on anything outside of himself. It spoke to Israel what their God was in himself rather than of what he would be in relation to this. So in a full accord with this, the aspect of his character on which God laid the most stress in the Old Testament was his holiness. Again and again, it was stressed that we must keep our place and our distance in the presence of a holy God, and this emphasis overshadowed everything else. So he's saying, like if you read the Old Testament, you'll notice over and over and over again that the name the Lord is used for God. Anytime you read an English translation, the Lord, and all four letters of Lord are capitalized. That is the name Yahweh, and just translated into our English Bibles. It was God's way of saying, I'm a holy God. I am unlike anyone you know or have ever seen or have ever experienced. Packer continues. He says, but in the New Testament, we find that things have changed. The stress of the New Testament is not on the difficulty and danger of drawing near to a holy God, but on the boldness and confidence with which believers may approach Him. A boldness that springs directly from faith in Christ and from the knowledge of His saving work. You can sum up the whole New Testament teaching with a single phrase if you speak of it as a revelation of the fatherhood of the Holy Creator. In the same way, you sum up the whole New Testament religion if you describe it as the knowledge of God as one's holy father. If you want to judge how well someone understands Christianity, find out how much he thinks of the thought of being God's child and having God as their father. And he's absolutely right. God refers to himself as father or father-like 15 times in the Old Testament. Jesus, by himself in the four Gospels, refers to God as Father 165 times. And that's not including Acts or the letters of Paul or the letters of Peter or James or the book of Hebrews. In the Old Testament, God's title was Yahweh, I am. In the New Testament, his title becomes Father. It doesn't change the character and nature of the God of the Old Testament. He is still a self-existent, independent God who created all things by his own power and might and who sustains it currently by his own power and might. He doesn't need any one of us. But that same God now has revealed himself through Jesus as our Father. And that changes everything. And that's what Jesus is saying. And this morning, we're going to look at specifically what that means in relationship to our generosity. So if you would, read with me Matthew chapter 6, 1 through 4. I'll read it out loud. You follow along. Jesus says, "Beware of practicing your righteousness, your good deeds, before other people in order to be seen by them. For then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. And your Father, who sees in secret, will reward you." Now, we live in a country that is the most generous country in the world. The average person, American citizen, gives twice as much to charity and charitable causes as the second place country. And in places like the Northeast or the inner city, I would imagine that that percentage actually skyrockets. We are very generous people, and more so, we're the church, Christians, are very generous people. They actually outpace the rest of the population in their generosity. And we know this even as we begin to kind of look at the landscape of all the different ministries that are out there. I mean, even in our own city, in our own region and area, we have Hope Faith Ministries, City Union Mission, Healing House, Elias Coffee, Jerusalem Farm, the Kansas City Rescue Mission, Catholic Charities, Mother's Refuge, the Lighthouse, among countless other ministries that are just based on generously serving the underprivileged. And then that's not even including, you know, national and international organizations like the Salvation Army or World Vision or Compassion. And I haven't even talked about the organizations that we as a church are connected with. Organizations like Global Orphan and Care Portal. Plus all the many ways that I know people in this church are generous with your neighbors and with your friends and with your family and with people you work with. We are a very generous people. And our country is a very generous country. But that's not exactly what Jesus is talking about this morning. Jesus' goal isn't that you would become generous. He assumes that you're going to be generous. And if you're a disciple of Jesus, his assumption is this: you will give to the needy. Verse 2, thus, when you give to the needy. So he's not going to implore you to be generous this morning. Instead, what Jesus is going to do is he's going to get underneath the motivations for why you're generous. And his encouragement for his disciples is this: the Father's love generates generosity. Be motivated by the love of your Father. The Father's love generates generosity in Jesus' disciples. And he works to this end by first going through two improper motives that we have for giving. The first improper motive, or wrong motive, is doing it to get praise from others. So look at verses 1 and 2 again. Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. For then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward. Now, we don't really know if these guys walked into the church or the temple like blowing a trumpet, right? And I don't think that's Jesus' point. I don't think he was trying to give us an historical record. And maybe some of you are like, well, I know they did. But they're like, I mean, anyways, that's not the point. The point Jesus is making is this: whoever, when they were giving, they would make sure that people knew that they were giving. They were being loud enough and were drawing attention to themselves enough so that people would look at their giving and begin to praise them. Say, that's a good job, or that's a lot of money you just gave. A lot of people are going to be blessed by what you just did. And that's what they lived for. And Jesus says, if that's what they lived for, that's all they got. They have gotten their reward. Now, Jesus, as we see here, he, in attacking this kind of mentality, he's after a generous heart. And so he uses the example of giving to the needy, giving money away. But really, he's after just what we give in general. He wants us to be generous in not only giving our money, but in giving our time and our treasure and our talent. He wants us to be generous people, people willing to do to meet needs around us. And in doing that, what he's kind of laying out is that these people were hypocrites. And this word hypocrite is a Greek word at the time that meant actor. What he's saying is, like, these people would use the world as their stage. And then they would just paint this image of themselves that they wanted other people to know. And what's worse is they would use the church to paint that for them. Or the synagogue, rather. They wanted people to think, I'm someone worthy of your worship and your love. And here's why. Like, we understand what that looks like today. I mean, we're all on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. Like, we know, when we have seen the posts from people we know who are having a really difficult time, are really struggling, and all of a sudden they post something on Facebook, you're like, that's not true. You know it because you've done it. I know it because I've done it. We have this natural desire in us to paint this image, to give this image to the world of who we want them to see and not really who we are. And he's calling that out. And we see that over and over and over again in our culture. Like, our culture values the end result, not the motivation in giving. And because of that, we see this kind of hypocrisy all the time. The person who always one-ups you in a conversation, like, you're trying to tell them about something you did that was amazing or something that was really hard, and they're like, oh, that's nothing. Right? And then they start in on this conversation like, I got to do this and this, and it's always better, it's always worse, or always somehow like more important than you are. Or the person, or the billionaire, you know, who lets people know, I gave $1 million to this organization. And we're like blown away, not realizing like $1 million compared to $1 billion is like taking a dime out of $100 bill. But yet he still wants praise. Are all these commercials where companies labor to let you know that they meet the needs of the people around them. They're a socially conscious organization that's worthy of your money and your services. Or perhaps my favorite, the Twitter humble brag. You know, this person who talks about how hard things are, but really they're just trying to tell you how awesome they are. One, and it's a real tweet, was this: I just did something very selfless, but more importantly, it was genuine, and I know it means a lot to the person in the long run. Hashtag so worth it. That's a real tweet. Like, that's something I thought a person in a sketch would make up, but this person really sent it. And I just want to go and ask them, were you just being silly? Were you just pulling a joke on someone? But each of these people and each of these types of companies, they're just hypocrites. They are actors trying to sell an image to the world for praise and appreciation. They are just like the people that Jesus is describing here. People just like us. We all have this desire in us to be worshipped, to be loved. And so we'll drop into the middle of the conversations, ways that we've been generous, or ways that we've been good, or ways that we've slaved away. Whenever we need to defend ourselves, we defend ourselves by throwing out all the good things that we've done. Even if what people are saying to us is true, we'll try to explain it away by boasting about all of our generosity and sacrificial attitudes. Or we'll make sure that people know what causes or what organizations we give to. Why do we do that? Jesus says on one hand, it's to get praise from others, but what kind of others, what kind of praise are we really seeking for here? I think there are two types of praise that we're seeking. Depending on where you're at and the day that you're seeking it. On one hand, the first one is that you're just seeking someone's worship. You think you're really awesome and you want other people to know. So maybe it's the fact that you spent all day at the house cleaning the floors, vacuuming, doing the laundry, making sure the house looks good, the kids are fed or whatever, and your spouse walks in the door and you just want them to tell you you're awesome because you know you're awesome. That took a lot of work, and it does take a lot of work. And the moment it doesn't happen, you feel defeated. Or maybe it's that I mow the grass, I fix something at the house, and it's okay, now I'm Superman because I know how to use a screwdriver. Praise me. Right? Or it could be, the opposite. Someone doesn't think you're doing your share. Someone doesn't think that you're living up to their expectations. So you use that opportunity to tell them and remind them how great you are and how wonderful you are and how they should be glad to have you. We want to be worshiped. So we sound our trumpet. On the flip side of that is we just want to be loved. We'll brag about ourselves, not because we think we're awesome, but because we're insecure and we think we're nothing. And we just want to feel appreciated. We just want to feel loved. And so when we begin to not feel appreciated, we lash out. And we start throwing out this long list of how we've sacrificed, how we've given everything we've gotten to this, and they should appreciate and love us, and they're not, and we deserve it. Or there's someone in our lives we so desperately want to win their approval that we'll start to just throw out all the ways that we're just like it. I give to the same causes. I'm a very good and sacrificial person. And then we'll commit all of our time and resources to that person just to try to get them to love us and want us, because somehow their approval means the world to us. And the sad thing is, Jesus says, if that's what you're after, that worship or that love from someone else, that's all you'll ever get. If you even get it. We know how this goes. Just because you tell people how awesome you are doesn't guarantee they're going to worship you. And just because you tell people how underappreciated you are and why they should love you doesn't mean they're going to love you. In fact, it can actually, this type of person actually isn't a faithful giver at all. They're not really a consistently generous person, because over time, they're always looking for a reaction to what they do. And if they're not getting that reaction, they're not going to do it anymore. Like if you were to come in and slap down a check for $1,000 and say, this is my tithe, we would at first go, that's crazy. Thank you. That's so generous. You come in the next week and do it, we'll go, oh, thank you. Thank you for serving and giving like that. You come in the third week, we might just go, oh, thanks. And by week number four, we might not even say anything. And if you're only doing that because you want the reaction of you're so awesome, by week number four, you're not going to want to give anymore. Because your internal need to be worshipped and praised and to feel loved isn't getting met. And it's this insidious thing. And you can see the wisdom of Jesus in this. That's the only reward you're going to get. And it's why he's encouraging his disciples to lean into the love of the Father. Because the Father's love will generate generosity in us. But that's not the only that's not the only way that we wrongly are motivated to give. He gives a second reason for this, and it's found in verse 3 and in the beginning of verse 4. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. This idea that your left hand isn't to know what your right hand is doing is kind of an impossibility, right? If you're writing a check, you know you're writing a check. And if you're writing a check to a specific organization, you know you're writing a check to that organization. Like, there's some semblance of knowledge there. But what Jesus is actually saying here is he's using this metaphor of the to say this. May your giving be normal to your everyday life, to the point that you don't even dwell on it. You don't have to think about it. You are a naturally generous person. And being naturally generous, you don't dwell on what you've given or sacrificed or given up. You only dwell on the fact you've met the need. It's this initial heart issue that he's dealing with that would keep us from becoming self-righteous at all. Because what he's saying is it keeps us from having this mental scorecard in our head that said of how much better or how much worse we are than others. Because Jesus wants to change our motivation, and not to give us a legal precedent to uphold. One of my errors in reading this passage and reading some of the Sermon on the Mount is I would take what he says, which is this, he's railing against legalism, and then I would take what he says and the commands and make them like this legalistic checklist to accomplish. And so in reading this passage, what I would do is I'd go, okay, no one can know what I give. As if that's what he's after. He's not after the fact that your giving is anonymous. He's not after the fact that your giving has to be in total secret because people are going to find out. My wife is going to know when I give money away. People will know when you give to the church. What he's after is that he's after a heart that doesn't care what people know. He's after a heart that is naturally generous and wants to meet the needs of others around them when they can. So his focus isn't that people know you give, it's that you wouldn't give just so they know. And his focus isn't that you would not know that you give, but that you wouldn't dwell on giving. His desire is that your giving is so normal to you that you wouldn't even consider giving as a sacrifice. It would be a natural part of your life to be generous. Like, what does this look like? In my mind, it's like this. You see a need. Like, you see that your neighbor has a need. And then your focus is immediately on, okay, how can I help them? And if you're able to meet that need, then you do. And if you're not, you can't. And that's okay. You're not beating yourself up because you're not able to meet a need that you can't meet. But if you are, you do it and then you move on. You don't expect praise or thank you for meeting the need. And in fact, maybe perhaps you even give in such a way that you kind of keep them from doing that. Not that you're doing it all shady, but that you're not doing kind of the annoying thing of just lingering around, like waiting for someone like, hey, What do you say? Like what I do with my boys. Hey, what do you say? Thank you. Like you're not doing that. You don't keep a mental note for the next time you have a need and then pulling it out and say, hey, you know how I helped you this one time? You should help me this time. And you're not keeping this mental note around so that the next time you're with them, you can keep bringing up how much they owe you. Not because you really expect them to pay, but just because you can hold it over them. You give, you meet the need, and then you forget about it. And there's this crazy thing that happens. Like, when you meet people like this, they don't even know how generous they really are. Like, these are the type of people, if you ever met someone, they're like, hey, I just want to really say thank you for giving this to me. I really appreciate it. They're like, what are you talking about? Oh, that was nothing. And then they just kind of leave it. Have you ever met someone like that? It's not that they are like falsely pushing away your gratitude. It's that they genuinely don't consider what they did to be a generous thing, even though it was. It's just, that's who they are. And Jesus talks about these type of people in Matthew chapter 25. When he's talking about the final judgment, he talks about those who are his sheep, and he welcomes in. And he says this to them. He says, I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Then listen what the righteous say to him. The righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry? When did we feed you? When were you thirsty and we gave you a drink? When did we see you as a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? They're like oblivious to what they've done. But Jesus is confirming to them, this is how you have lived your life. And they're like, when did we do that? They have not kept this mental scorecard. And Jesus actually says, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. Like, we can see immediately how difficult this type of life is. Like, I can't make myself like this. And in fact, I'm so wired that if I walk around like, hey, don't be thinking about this. Don't think about giving. Don't think about what I just did. I will think about it all day. It's kind of like telling you, hey, don't think about a zebra. Most of you, if not all of you, just pictured a zebra. The brain is wired that way. What has to happen is you have to have a change of heart. You have to have something or someone transform you from the inside out. And this is why Jesus gives us the third way of giving for the reward of the Father. At the very end of verse 4, so that your giving may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. There are three things in this very short sentence that we learn about God. And they're amazing. The first one is this: God is your Father. If you are a disciple of Jesus, if you are a Christian, God is your Father. Now, our broken, messed up world has made a mess of fatherhood. But God is not like a human father. God is a perfect Father. And in fact, if you go back and you just look at the Beatitudes in chapter 5, verses 3 through 12, you'll see what kind of Father he really is. He is a Father who loves you at your worst, when you have nothing to offer. If you come to him, he will not reject you, no matter what you've done. He is a Father who will comfort you when life crushes you, and when your own stupid, sinful mistakes come back on your head. He will not fly off the handle in anger or rage instead. He is a father who has an inheritance with you, for you. He will not leave you with nothing. He's not out to get you or to take from you. He is a father who will always be with you. He'll never leave you. He'll never forsake you. He'll never run out the door to get cigarettes and never come back. He will never let you down. He's a father who has mercy for you. He doesn't mock you or belittle you when you sin. He's a God who will open himself up to you. He's not closed off or distant. He's not someone you have to pry open to get to know. He is a father who will openly embrace you as his own because he is not ashamed of you. He is never ashamed to call you his child. And he is a father who will reward you for trusting him and enduring. He's a good father. And it's an amazing thing that Jesus says, the God who created all things, the God who does not need you at all, wants you to be his child and wants to be your father. The second thing we see from this passage about God is not only is he your father, but he's a father who sees you. Like there are times where it may seem like your sacrifices don't matter or go unnoticed. And there may be times where you feel like God or the world is pulling on you and you're having to give up so much and you're just wondering if it's worth it. And there are times where you feel like you're suffering in silence and you don't know if anyone is going to care or if anyone is going to comfort you or if anyone sees you at all. And Jesus says your Father sees you. You are so important to him that there is not a moment in your life where you're out of his sight. He sees you. He's with you. And then thirdly, your Father will reward you. Like some of us may have this natural recoil in us that goes, oh, God doesn't reward us. Or even it's shameful to say, hey, you should do this so you can get something from God. But that's exactly what Jesus is saying. You should strive to become this naturally generous person because your Father will reward you. And he's not talking about the prosperity gospel here. He's not talking about you're going to get mansions and you're going to get, you know, sow a seed and you'll get it tenfold back. He's talking about a reward that Jesus has referenced over and over and over again in the Sermon on the Mount so far. And it's this reward in the kingdom of heaven. This reward where you will be rewarded by having more of God himself. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they are comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. They shall be satisfied. God is giving you more of himself in those moments. You are getting a more intimate and more closely related relationship to your Father. And Jesus says, looking forward in chapter 7, verse 14, he says, this is the way to life. This is the way into the kingdom of heaven. This means that those of us who live under the constant knowledge that God is our Father, and that's our motivation for giving, can expect a life full of the experience of knowing that we are in the presence of God here and now. And can know that we're heading toward an eternity where we will be in his presence forever and fully know him as he is. And this life in the presence of God as your Father, though, is only found as you follow Jesus. God the Father It's the father of the poor in spirit, the mourners, the gentle, and those who long for him. Is that you? Are you sitting here clinging to pride and arrogance, ignoring sin and your need for salvation? Are you self-righteous and harsh toward others? Do you look for others to give you praise and sustenance and worship and love? Are you keeping a mental checklist of how much better you are than everybody else? Or do you want to follow Jesus as your Lord and Savior and have and trust and the God as your Father to love you and sustain you and give you all that you need? If God is not your Father, His relationship to you then is as your judge. Jesus makes this clear in chapter 7. That for those who are sons of God, they are welcome into the kingdom, and those who are not are cast out into darkness. But the good news for all of us this morning is that God is a Father who adopts the worst of us. There's not a person in this room who is exempt from His adoption. And there's not a person in this room who, once adopted by Him as their child, can ever do anything that would make Him throw you out. So wherever you're at this morning, let's spend some time calling out to Him and crying out to Him in repentance and confession, turning to Him, longing to trust Him as our Father, longing to find our approval and acceptance in His love and not the love of others. Like, what other faith has a God like this? A God who is eternal and unchanging, not needing anything, but yet a God who is personally attached to His people as their Father. Like, what an amazing God we actually have that would love us like this, that would send His only begotten Son to save sinners like you and I so that we could become His children too. And it's this Father's love toward us that actually will generate generosity within us when we realize all that we've been given and all that we have still coming toward us. So some questions this morning are, first, do you see or know God as your Father? Even if you're a follower of Jesus, is that the title that you know God by? And I understand there might be a lot of baggage with that term, Father. But He is a good Father, unlike the human fathers we've all had or not had. He loves you and He's for you. Do you know Him as your Father? What would it look like this morning to take a step to just trusting Him more by who He says He is as your Father? Secondly, are you someone who gives? Are you generous? And if you are, why? Are you this person who gives because of the reaction of others? Are you someone who gives simply because it's like storing it in your mental, holy, righteous bank? Are you someone who gives because you know how much has been given to you and you know how much you're loved and you know that God is your Father and He'll take care of you? And then lastly, I want us to take a moment this week to prioritize your giving so that it honors God. And we have ways at this church that you can give. I mean, first and foremost, we have our tithing, our offerings. What would it look like for you just to value that and take a step to just say, okay, the summer might be busy for us. How can I make sure to continue to give in a way, not so I can earn the church's favor, but so I can show that I'm a child of the Father? And this is what He knows is good for me. I can't emphasize enough, I don't know who gives and I don't know how much. My encouragement to you is to trust God in this. Secondly, what would it look like to give of your time to work the fireworks tent? If you're able to do that, great. But if you're not, that's okay too. But what would it look like for you to take seriously, just considering, okay, God, you've given us as a church this opportunity. And I want to trust you in it, and I want to take advantage of it. I want to give my time. And then thirdly, what would it look like for you to have a heart of generosity coming to the VBS meeting next week, just ready to jump in wherever you can? Not so you can get praise from us, though you might. Encouraging one another is not frowned upon. Not so that you can win points with God. You don't need to. But simply so you can love and serve and be generous like He has been to you. The Father's love generates generosity in His disciples. Let's rest in that this morning. Let's pray.